This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Write On, showcasing the work and lives of Otago and Southland writers. Tune in for news and interviews with your local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon till 1 and repeated the following Sunday at 1 p.m. Kindly sponsored by the great team at the University Bookshop. What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Good afternoon and welcome. My name is Beverly Martins, and it's my pleasure to introduce the spring edition of Write On. So join us for the next hour when we talk to two compelling writers. First up, Dr. Susan Woodell. And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Susan Woodell. Susan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Beverly.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm just going to give a bit of basic bio info for our listeners. And I was just thinking, reading all of that could be a whole separate interview, your kind of academic life. But just briefly, so Susan, you've got a PhD in social anthropology and communication studies. Mm-hmm. You're currently a senior lecturer in anthropology at the University of Otago. Mm-hmm. And you had or doing some major research projects like medical crowdfunding, mm-hmm, and some stuff to do with post the Christchurch mosque shootings.
That's
which
right.
Are incredibly interesting. And as I say, we could do a whole other thing on that. But what we want to do today, of course, is talk about your creative writing. Mm-hmm. Because, boy, it just feels like 2023 has been your year. Now, I know there's that great saying about the seven-year overnight success.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, you know, you're beavering away in the background and working really hard and kind of making small steps that some people don't notice, and then suddenly, boomf. So I'm just going to run through a couple of your recent successes,
sure,
which you deserve huge congratulations for. One is that you've just won Best First Book at the New Zealand Book Awards for Children and Young Adults for The Lighthouse Princess. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back to that. And the second, of course, is that you were the winner of this year's New Zealand Poetry Society Poetry Competition out of some 2,000 entries worldwide, we'll talk about that later too. Mm. And in fact, I'll get you to read your winning poem if you would. So let's go back to and talk about The Lighthouse Princess, which is a really charming book about a princess who doesn't need rescuing.
That's right.
And I read somewhere that it was kind of, it's been 9 years from the initial idea, mm-hmm, through to holding that book in your hand.
That's right.
Yeah, so talk me through that and tell me how you sort of kept the faith, as it were.
Yeah, well, a lot of it is that patience through the process, isn't it? And especially as a first-time author in any field, really, there's a lot that you have to learn about how the industry works and publishing works, as well as a lot that you have to learn about the kind of craft of the genre you're working in. So that nine-year period spanned from the first time when I was walking along the beach and had this first spark or seed of an idea came together, and that was before I even had my children. And then life shifted in many ways,
course,
and suddenly,
yeah,
I had these small people who love to listen to stories. So it became an oral form of storytelling for bedtimes. And then being that I love writing and I'm always tinkering away and writing on other forms, of course, at some point I thought, well, I should put this down on the page. And then it began a whole other process of editing and refining, sending it to publishers, getting rejections, waiting several years, and eventually being able to hold this little thing I'd created in my hands as a physical object, which was really amazing experience.
Because you did have another success with it, which was the Gavin Bishop Award, I think, in 2021. Now, was that the whole complete book at that point, or was that just the...
That was sort of part of the process, and it was really quite a privilege to be involved in that as well, because what was happened is that they chose my manuscript to be the text for the award. So the award is for first-time illustrators, so they send the text out broadly, and they ask anyone who wants to submit to send in a sort of sample drawing or portfolio, and that's how they select the illustrator for the book. So Rose Northey was the winner, and her sample drawings, then she was contracted to actually take on the illustration, and she is incredible, so I'm really, really lucky with that.
Right. Mm. So if I understand this right, that the text was sent out to more than one illustrator.
That's right, yeah.
And
it was so sent
there,
out
were, there were some different versions, and someone chose Rose as the match, which obviously. So was that a career boost for her as well?
Definitely. And it's very special actually to share the award for best first book in particular, because usually it goes to, you know, first time author or first time illustrator. But in this case, it's for both of us.
Yes, so I see what you mean. You get an experienced person working with a newbie, or the other way around.
Yeah,
and you were both in it together.
Yeah,
oh, that's lovely.
For us.
Have you got plans to work together in the future, or is it?
Oh, we certainly hope so. So there's a few things in the works that aren't official enough to announce, but you know, we would love to keep working together.
So
yeah,
start of a beautiful friendship, as they
say.
Yeah,
I think so.
Oh, that is brilliant. Oh, that's excellent, Susan. So what did you kind of learn in that process, or was there just so many things to learn? What was the...
Well, in some ways there were things that I had been learning in other genres I work in, like in poetry or flash fiction, about how to work in short form, you know, how to bring in world building and characterization and playfulness into just a few lines or a few words. So I was able to sort of develop that. But there are other things then that children's writing has of its own that I had to learn anew about how to write for children and their parents, because they're both your readers.
Yes, good point.
How to bring in sort of humor and levity and play, but also what was really important to me was to keep the story real, that it still said came from a real place and an authentic place. It wasn't just about amusement, but a good children's story can do both, you know. It can delight and stir in a deeper way. Yeah.
So you're talking about kind of the themes, if you like, here.
Yeah.
What do you think they are in The Lighthouse Princess? Is that...
Well, for me, it came from this place of sort of a feminist fairy tale, because in a way it's a kind of revision of Rapunzel, and a kind of introverted fairy tale, which is perhaps just me, and thinking about a wild life and a wild place and what it might be like to, you know, to live free and purposefully, but with good companionship as part of that. You know, not that your whole existence has to be staked around that, but that life is richer for the sharing. Mm. And so I think that's that place that it came from me, was this vision of a kind of empowered girl who, you know, knew where she was in the world and what she was doing, and enjoyed finding someone to share it with as well.
And do you think, because you live... Is it on the peninsula or by the harbour?
I live by the harbour in West Harbour, which is wonderful, but also was living for a while on the peninsula and, you know, frequent as many beaches in the region as I can. So, yeah, it was inspired by Allen's Beach in particular, actually, and a walk along Allen's Beach.
Fantastic. Mm. Lovely. Mm. So let's turn our attention now to your second big win of the year. And we'll come back to some other things later, because... Believe you me, these are not the only two things that you've been doing this year or you're about to do. But let's just talk about winning the New Zealand Poetry Society poetry competition. Why did you want to enter that, and what? Tell me about your poem before
The New Zealand Poetry Society is a really important part of our kind of ecosystem in New Zealand, and do a lot of amazing work. This year's competition I was particularly excited by, because the judge for this year is Nina Minyo-Powles, who's an incredibly accomplished and amazing contemporary young New Zealand writer, and she writes essays, she writes poetry to much acclaim, and I've read both and have been sitting quite deeply with her essay collection just earlier earlier in the year, and I was quite excited, even at just the thought that some of my work might pass under her gaze on the desk. So it was, you know, doubly exciting to then actually have her, you know, like and respond to it and select it as a prize winner.
And I believe that, is it coming out in an anthology? Or it'll be coming out in print form at some point, won't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so the Poetry Society do an anthology every year with the winners and a selection of other wonderful entries, and it's, you know, jam-packed full of goodness. So that usually comes out towards the end of the year.
Right.
Yeah.
So we're lucky enough to have a sneak preview now. If you
Absolutely.
Would read, do you want to give any context, or would you like to just read it, Susan?
Well, the poem's called Radishes. It uses a form on the page where it has kind of slashes between lines, which of course won't quite translate verbally, but hopefully you'll still get the kind of feel of it. And it came out of a time in my life when I was doing a lot of gardening, and I had very young children, and I was thinking a lot about, I don't know, life and big feelings in these spaces where I would get kind of this breath of fresh air outside the house, just digging in the garden and, you know, domestic life and everything we pack into it. So I guess that's the place where it's coming from. It's just a short, simple little poem. And for a long time, I thought of it as, a strange little poem, not exactly one of my dazzling longer works. And I put in some other things I thought of as more dazzling works to the competition. And so it was a lovely affirmation in a way to have this strange little poem that was so close to my heart picked up actually as the one that had some merit perhaps. So it's, I guess, an encouragement to writers in general that the things that stir and move you, it doesn't have to be the stuff that feels deeply literary, but things that matter to you, that communicates to people.
Yeah. I think when you are learning the craft of writing, there's a lot of emulation that goes on.
Yes.
And I know that sometimes it can take quite a long time to find your own voice because you feel like you should be sort of more clever or more literary. And
I think cleverness kills my writing more than anything else. As soon as I try and get clever, it goes astray. But if I stay honest, perhaps that's the way to put it.
I think it's because, generally people go into your head too much. And
yeah,
you need to
stay in your heart and in your body, yes, I think
absolutely.
So, yeah.
All right.
So this is the poem, Radishes. I am Googling what to do with radishes. When life gives you radishes and you are ill-prepared to make radishade, and radishade apparently doesn't exist, and you have just crawled out of a forest of years you can barely remember with hands like claws. Hold your radishes like a baby. Hold your radishes like a trophy. Hold your radishes to your heart and give thanks. No matter what the internet advises about salads you'll never eat. You have a root here. You have the white hot heart of it. You need no recipe for coming up out of the dark.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
Oh, and I can completely relate to that because when I was a child, we were each given a small part of Dad's garden.
Mm.
And what did we grow? Radishes.
Did you?
Because they were a winner. They were a 3-week winner. They were quick, fast, and you could eat them. And you know what? Sometimes now I still grow radishes.
And they'll contain a lot of memories for you then?
They do, but also, but I relate to about Googling with them because actually they're quite limited. I mean, they're lovely, and I, happily give them to the neighbour's kids.
Yeah.
And I will use a few of them. But actually, if the whole crop strikes, you're like, what do I do with radishes?
Yeah, and I'm very much only a beginner gardener. I don't really know what I'm doing. Like most things in life, I tend to just throw myself at it and work it out along the way. And so I guess in some ways the parallels to other areas of life or parenting or who knows what we're doing. You know, we Google it, we try and work out. Life throws everything at us, including
radishes.
But
hating the waste thing too. Like you want to use up every, if you've grown it, you want to use up every last radish.
But we find our way.
We do. So there's been some other poetry things that you've been doing. One in particular was just a couple of weeks ago, of course, you were judging for the National Poetry Day event at the library, which is fabulous, wasn't it, a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, for the children's section.
And you did the children's section there. So was that the first time you've been on the other side, like the judging side of it, and how was all of that?
I have done one round of judging before, which was for ethnographic poetry, which is that area that fuses my creative work and my academic work. But it was a little bit different and different feeling, and it was certainly the first time I had judged anything with children's writing, which felt quite different and quite, you know, quite an important thing when we're caring for young people's words and writing as well.
And young people's hearts too, in terms of, you know, wanting to sort of look after them, because it's quite pretty gutsy to make an entry. Just before we go on to that though, could you sort of explain ethnographic
poetry? Ethnography in my field and more broadly is the type of research that looks at kind of in-depth knowledge about people's lived worlds and their experiences in a particular place and time. So ethnographic poetry is poetry that sort of tries to do that as well. It's interested in culture and society, but through this kind of rooted lens of looking at a particular person or community in a place and a time, and using that to understand some things about the culture and society around them.
So if I called it literary archaeology, would it be sort of something along those lines?
It would connect to that a bit. It's not so much archaeology in that it focuses on past societies, it's more contemporary societies, but certainly it does that thing of blending together the academic lens and research and analysis and a literary mode of writing, where we're using all those amazing poetic techniques to kind of, you know, open up someone's experience in their life world, whether that's coming from, you know, writing about somewhere and someone familiar to us, or a different place and community that we've gone to and studied.
So it can be a way in.
It invites you.
Brilliant. All right. So, sorry, back to the...
the children's poetry.
Yes. Tell me about that and how you chose the winners and what the sort of process was.
Yeah, it's strangely confronting being a judge, because it does make you suddenly think about what makes good writing in a different way than what you do when you're the one doing the writing. So it's very helpful in a way to be forced to step back and think. And in particular, what I was noticing was striking me were poems that had a sort of specificity to them. And I certainly remember that from my own writing, even when I was a young person, was I often defaulted to very big universal themes and speaking in a very abstract, flourishing way. But the poems that stood out to me may speak to universal themes, but they do it with reference to really specific images from that person's actual life, you know, the kind of textured details of life. And so that really helps to grab a reader. And the second thing is voice and how a poem kind of addresses you. And I guess it's similar in that if something sort of speaking in a grand way off to the side, then, you know, it feels like you're maybe witnessing something but at a distance, whereas certain poems that speak to you, sometimes with quite a colloquial voice, that ask a question of you or address you as a reader, like they really bring you into it. So those were the poems that stood out to me.
I'd agree with that. You're in the room, or, you know,
you're part of it.
Absolutely. Right, so you've got that. I also, both of us were at the launch of the Readers and Writers Festival.
Yes, very
event
excited
last
for that.
Night, which was brilliant, and a really comprehensive program coming up mid next month, from the 13th to the 15th of October. You are doing one of the sessions at the library. And I'm going to read what the program says, and then I'd love you to sort of expand on that and tell me kind of who should come and what they could kind of expect. So it is your, obviously you can talk about the Lighthouse Princes, and lead interactive exercises using the body, senses and heart to draw on experience for the telling of creative and magical stories. Now that's quite a setup.
It is. It's so ambitious.
So yeah. Can you kind of break that down?
Sure.
For us. And,
yeah. So I'm really interested in addressing the young people that will come as writers and storytellers themselves, because it's very inherent to human nature, and children are already storytellers, and then often they're also in a context of school where they're learning to do that through writing. What I like to speak to children about is that idea that, you know, you write from the heart and you write from experience, and you use your body to gather up knowledge about the world. You look, you listen, you smell, you touch, you taste, you experience things, and then that becomes what you can write from and what enriches your writing to draw on that. So a little like we were discussing before, I guess, of, you know, it's not all just in your head, and it can involve, of course, imagination and fantastical and invented things, but often when that's grounded in your lived experience, it gives it a certain effectiveness in drawing others in.
And what sort of age range are you expecting to come along to that? Like,
oh, it could be a real variety.
Really?
I imagine. I think we'll get, the book seems to speak to a really broad range of people, but anywhere from 2 or 3 years old up to 10 years old or 12 years old, because I think, they can connect with the topic in a different way depending on where they're at with their own writing and storytelling.
Mm. Brilliant. Oh, look forward to that.
Yeah.
You've got a lot on your plate, clearly.
I do, rather.
You're a mum, you've got work at the university, you're doing all these creative things. I think, do you have any kind of writing routine, or is it fitted in when and if kind of thing? Like, how do you juggle?
It's pretty ad hoc, just because of who I am and how I work. But the main thing, the guideline I have for myself, is less about when I write and more about noticing where I am at and what I'm capable of in that given moment, where my energy's at, where my mind's at, and finding the moments of time that I need by, like, leaning into them when they're there. So, if I happen to be in that really creative space and the ideas are there, if at all possible, I just let myself lean into that, never mind what was written down on the schedule. And, of course, there's limits to that because I do have fixed commitments.
Yes,
but,
of course.
Yeah, and if I'm in a very added academic, analytical frame of mind, I try and follow that as much as I can. And
so it sounds like you've got several muses within your head, and you will go to which one is calling you. Obviously, you've got deadlines. I mean, who doesn't have deadlines? And sometimes deadlines, I think, can be a brilliant thing because
deadline.
Yeah,
keeps me on track. But
yes, they will force you to, and competitions can be quite good for that.
Very good.
Yeah,
just
sort of submit something.
Definitely.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's interesting about going down the different tracks as you can.
And I think, different brains work differently, and, like, I'm neurodivergent, so I've had to recognise that my brain and my working styles won't always fit with what other people do or expect, and learning to work with that rather than fight against it has actually been really helpful for me. And it does mean that because of other privileges and supports in my life as well, I have been able to be fairly productive with what I'm doing, and partly just because I try to let myself go with it. Go with the strengths, go with the opportunities.
Do you see, like, your sort of academic career and your creative writing career as kind of separate silos, or do you really feel that there's a crossover? Or
such a good question, and it's shifted over the years from being more separate to bringing it together quite deliberately, which is something I've wanted to do and cherished. And I now have a whole space which is, where I'm writing poetry about my research or creative essays using my data from fieldwork or teaching my students using poetry. So there's a whole area in the middle. And I love to use the metaphor of cross-pollination, partly because I love bees, but partly just because I think it really works to get this sense of it is actually the mixing between different spaces and different genres and different themes and different modes of thinking that has been really generative for me. That's where some of the most interesting and good bits come from often, is actually bringing them together.
See, yeah, I think that's really interesting. I'm just wondering if some of the well-deserved successes you've had this year have kind of legitimised that for you too, that you don't see your creative writing as a kind of a sideline hobby, if you know what I mean, you know, like that.
Yeah.
Because you've had those successes, you are able to integrate them.
That's exactly right. It creates a little bit of a paper trail when you're forging your own path a little bit and doing your career a little differently than others. It helps to be able to point to a few things like that and say, you know, this is a possible path.
Yes.
It can work.
Yes.
And so hopefully that makes the way for other people to do
it. I was going to say, not only is it encouraging, you know, for your own self-satisfaction and your own things that you want to get done, it's actually going to be, you know, a signal for some other people as well. Are there any other upcoming projects that you can kind of talk about at the minute, or...?
Gosh, I mean, I'm tinkering with many things at once, as I often do, and moving between them as I have an opportunity. I'm still working with essays a bit. And the other thing in the program there that I'm also doing a panel with some other amazing people on essays and essay writing. So I think that's on my mind as well as some children's book manuscripts at different parts of the process. But, yeah, hopefully there'll be other news in the future.
Fantastic, Susan. Look, we could do a whole other program on
you.
and I look forward to that because I know that this is just the start of things for you and you're going to just get more and more traction. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, for me too.
And for any listeners that would like to know more, I encourage you to look at Susan's website, which is susanwardellwriter.com. Thanks again, Susan.
Thank you, Beverly.
That was absolutely brilliant, wasn't it? So now we're just going to take a short musical break, playing one of my favourite Kiwi bands, the Tattletale Saints, and then we'll be back with our second guest after the break.
I want to go to Montgomery. I want to make a spark and see if I can set myself alight and burn away. Cause something once started here, I don't care, I ain't got no fear. You live and then you die in the same place. I will sing Hank Williams songs, they must be right, cause honey, he ain't wrong. Jesus must have taught that boy to play. Let it soak into my blood, then baby I can feel the love that taught a million people how to sing. One step forward, two steps back, a shift is gonna get my spirit on track. Cause I write better songs when I'm away. I won't set the woods on fire, I'll get out of this world alive. I ain't lived so I can't die in this place. I will sing Hank Williams songs, they must be right, cause honey, he ain't wrong. Jesus must have taught that boy to play. Let it soak into my blood, then baby I can feel the love that taught a million people how to sing. Cause honey, he ain't wrong. Jesus must have taught that boy to play. Let it soak into my blood, then baby I can feel the love. It's taught a million people how to sing. It's taught a million people how to sing.
do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Welcome back to the second half of Write On with your new host, Beverly Martins. Just before I get to our mystery second guest, I'm just going to talk about the Tattletale Saints for a minute, because that was what you heard in the musical break. They're one of my favourite Kiwi bands, or should I say duos, and I've been lucky enough to see them live twice in Otipoti, Dunedin, which is a rare treat now because they've decamped to Nashville and doing very well over there. Right, back to the second guest of the show, who in fact is someone incredibly familiar to you, Dr. Vanda Simon. As we know, Vanda has been the host of the show for the last, can you believe it, 18 years. And she has, I mean, that's incredible. That's a whole second, or should I say third career for you, Vanda, because, I mean, clearly you've got your work done at the university. You've got your whole writing career with five great thrillers under your belt now. And now, you know, you're understandably hanging up the microphone here after 18 years. So what we're going to do is just reminisce, actually, for about the next 20 minutes or so, because there's been amazing stories in those last 18 years. So let's go back to the beginning, which I understand was quite accidental in terms of you becoming the host of this. So tell me about that, Vanda.
Thank you, Beverly, for inviting me back to the show, which I thought was kind of fun. And also just a really nice way, I think, to round it out and to, you know, like I say, tell some of the better work stories from having done a radio show for the last 18 years. But certainly I had absolutely no intention whatsoever of ever being a radio show host. Not even slightly. And it was one of those strange opportunities that came about. One of our other members, Lydia, and I'm sorry, I cannot remember her surname, she had decided that, hey, community radio is a great avenue or a great way to talk about, get authors and local people, writers on air, getting some publicity about their books and things. And she came to, she was a member of our local Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors, and she said, you know, why don't we do a radio show? And she was going to organise it, and she was all prepared to front it as the host and everything. And so I'd gone along with her as kind of, I was president of the local branch at the time. And so I'd gone along with her to when she was organising these things. And what was then, I think it was Radio Tauroa back then, was what the station was called, and Ros Rice was the manager at that stage. And Ros had managed to jack up a sponsor even. So, you know, we had the time slot for the show, we had a sponsor. So our first sponsor was Java Hair Studio.
Right.
Who, I think it was at opposite Gallery de Novo, where there is a bar restaurant now, Wolf, I think. That's where the hair salon was. So we had a sponsor and everything like that, and it was all good to go, and Lydia was going to front the show and do all that. And then she got offered a job out of town. And it was like, oh, okay.
And what was the time frame? I mean, was this like a week before or?
Oh, about a month.
Oh, about a month. Okay.
Yeah. So it did have a little bit of time. And so Ros was like, well, hey, you know, we've got a sponsor lined up. You've got a slot. Surely someone can front up and host this radio show. So it was a case of, okay, with very much fear, trepidation, I got volunteered, essentially. No one asked what their hand up to do it. So I was like, okay, I'll do that. And yeah, 18 years later, I finally get to sidle out of the station and make my exit.
So the fact that it was Guy Fawkes Day back in 2005. I mean, how nervous were you? It's a big ask, isn't it?
Terrified. Absolutely terrified. I'd never done anything like that before. I hadn't really done much in the way of public speaking or anything. And bless them, I thought, okay, so I've got to have a guest for this first show. So thank you so much to my first guests, which were Penelope Todd, Maxine Alterio and Carolyn McCurdy. And I thought it was quite lovely for my last show that I hosted last month or a couple of months ago. It was I had those three lovely women back, 18 years later.
I know. I thought that was lovely, but also it does show you how far people come in that time too, because they're mid-career writers now.
Yes.
And they would have been first books back then. Perhaps not Penelope, but certainly I think, you know, Maxine and
Carolyn at once.
So, I mean, and that's really the sort of kaupapa of the show, isn't it? I think.
Giving that platform, because it's really, really hard for local authors or even New Zealand authors in general to get any airtime or publicity time or print space as far as promotion of our books is concerned. All that space tends to be given to your international bestsellers and all the people who don't actually need the promotion there. So one of the core fundamentals of why we did the show in the first place was giving that platform, that opportunity to be heard, to get your books out there. And also a nice little way of practicing being part of that whole media circus, you know, before you get to be interviewed by Kim Hill, come into our nice little local studio and get interviewed by Evander. It's a little, you know, in a more relaxed space.
Oh, I think it's been a real cornerstone of the things that happen in Dunedin. I think what's also lovely about it is realising how much talent and how, I mean, the sort of kind of format of the show is sort of two different interviews every time. And boy, the slots get booked up, don't they? Because there is just such a wealth of writers here in, you know, Otago Southland area. So do you want to maybe talk about the range of interviews that you've done?
So, you know, as you just said, such a creative space, Otago, Southland and Dunedin, and authors are being published all the time. So I had no difficulty in filling up the slots. And as you sort of commented,
booked up for Christmas, folks.
Yeah. We've had no problem having people who are generally delighted to have that opportunity to talk on radio. And purposefully went out to not just talk to authors, talk to many, many authors, but also just other, you know, other people in that book industry. I've talked to illustrators, publishers, booksellers. You know, a lovely regular slot that I had with Bronwyn and Wiley Gibb of the University Bookshop. Again, University Bookshop being one of those core fundamental sponsors of the radio show, and just, you know, chatting books with her regularly. So it was really good having that cross section of the whole industry, as it were. Had, you know, photographers and to speak and talk with. So
What do you think, I mean, as well as giving them a platform and expanding their opportunities, what do you think that's done for you and your reading and your kind of knowledge?
Yeah, it's been brilliant because, you know, I'm the kind of girl, I like to over-prepare. So I always made sure that I read the works of the people that I was interviewing. So it meant that I read things that I would not normally ever pick up just for my own choice of leisure reading, things like that. So it expanded my reading horizons immensely. I read quite a few number like biographies over the years, local histories. Fascinating. I would normally not have picked up just like little local histories, whether, you know, from a town in Clutha or about a little individual or even a power company, things like that. But they were really, really interesting, and it's made me more likely to pick them up and actually buy them now and read them, which has been great. I do have to confess that I've never really been into poetry. And in the course of doing this show, I've interviewed many lovely poets. And I will point out that poets in particular need airtime, they need print time, because it's very difficult for poets and to get reviewed in any space. So I took great pleasure in interviewing as many poets as I could. But it meant that I got to enjoy and learned to enjoy poetry, whereas before it wasn't, again, something that I would have normally purchased. But lo and behold, nowadays I find myself actually buying poetry collections, like voluntarily, and enjoying them, and really enjoy the particularly I have to put a hat tip out to Dear Sue Wharton, who was one of the first poets that I interviewed, and I discovered and really enjoyed the vein of humour that sort of flowed through her work.
It does. It flows through her books as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. And Emma Neal's another poet whose works I could really identify with the whole sort of motherhood angle of that she was taking, and just sort of the fun and play that she had with words. So, that again just hugely broadened my reading horizons.
Fantastic. And I mean, doing the maths, we're talking about nearly 400 interviews over that time, which is astonishing and exhausting to think about in terms of, cup of tea and a lie down. But there have been some really rich veins within that. Mm. And, of course, it's been the whole emphasis on local, regional, national, and then international because of our Readers and Writers Festivals that occur every couple of years here. So shall we look at some of those because they're probably more of a standout because they were kind of the big names. And how did some of that go?
Yeah, so one of the privileges, I suppose, and perks of having started doing this lovely small community radio show and building the skills of being able to interview people and feel confident doing it. I found myself, one of the opportunities that came up was being invited to interview people when they came to the country. So I got to snaffle a few international superstars, which was very, very exciting.
We're going to name drop people.
Yeah, I am shamelessly name dropping, I tell you, honestly. I am totally shamelessly name dropping here. So
shall we run through a few of them?
Yes.
And see what jogs your memory.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And I don't know if she is. She's both international and local, COVID permitting. Val McDermott. She must be a huge hero of yours.
Yeah. So Val McDermott has come to Dunedin a number of times with book tours over the years, but also in recent times as a visiting professor through the Centre for Irish and Scottish Studies at the University of Otago. And so I had, on a couple of occasions, had the opportunity to interview her for the radio show, but also as a guest interviewer in public audiences and things, which was an immense pleasure. The total fangirl. Yeah. And I'll be straight out there and say that. But also just the pleasure of getting to know her as a very cool person and become a friend, which was fantastic. One of the things I really enjoyed with Val, as well as talking about her work in general, was that she is just so incredibly knowledgeable about literature in general, crime, fiction and literature across the board. So had some wonderful discussions about, the origins of crime fiction and the history of it, the rich history and the underlying themes and things that are happening behind. So, she's incredibly clever.
Do you think that kind of started to inform your own writing in some way of just having the wider context?
Yes, yeah, definitely. Every interview, the reading that I had to do for these interviews, for example, with Val, of course, reading her works, which I had read her works before anyway, but it was, reading more of them. And across the many interviews that I've done, a broad variety of, in my genre, crime fiction, but other fiction, has been really good at informing my own work in terms of seeing what other people have done, the sort of underlying themes, realizing that crime fiction in particular, and I think this is, I'm just going to name drop again, we're talking with Ian Rankin.
You can't see us genuflecting, but we are.
all the hand gestures are going off. And that whole, his thing that he said, writing crime fiction in a way gives you a back ticket pass to the whole social structures and things that drive why people commit crimes. And you could just get into the human drama, the politics, the economics and everything.
Right. So sort of like outside underlying of your social factors. Strata, you start going up and down.
Yeah, and that it just, it gave you a platform to be able to just discuss so many, many things beyond, the obvious of a crime fiction, a murder or something like that, the why done-its and how important the why done-its. And I think that's very much translated over into my own work, where I think the why done it is more important than the who done it in many ways.
And then it's up to you to tell the how, isn't it, and make that interesting.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, I personally respond to the psychological within a story as much as the actual physicality of it all.
Yeah. And again, with my interviewing of Ian Rankin on the couple of times that he has been here, he very much cemented in me how important place is, because then as John Rebus novels, you know, Scotland and Edinburgh in particular are almost a character in their own right in his work. And so, you know, the benefit I personally got from talking with him and reading his work was having that rub off on my work, and I make, you know, Dunedin very much have a sense of place with this city.
You certainly do. Now, someone else with a really strong sense of place, and it's often a much more rural setting, is Annie Prue.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, her landscape is character within her stories, isn't it? So tell me about Annie.
So that was very, that was amazing. And again, I felt quite intimidated in a way getting to interview Annie Prue. She came to talk at the Dunedin Public Library. And that talk was based actually on her memoir, a book called Bird Cloud, which was a fabulous book.
I mean, if you get to read that book,
it was amazing. Yeah. So, you know, again, getting that opportunity to talk with her about that book was incredible. Like I said, slightly intimidating. She has a bit of a reputation of she can be a little bit cool, and
she's not a fall sufferer.
No. So I was a little nervous going into it, but she was actually really generous with her comments and with the interview, and most 99% of it went really well. There's only one stage where I kind of got told off, because I was asking a question and I don't think I actually worded it very well, and I was probably using New Zealand terminology, so she didn't quite get the gist of it. And the resultant thing was like, you're kidding me, right?
To the question.
And it was like, yes. So just trying to
explain
and get back into that, get back into the nice rapport I felt that we had going after that. So, yeah, like many people, I have been told off by Annie Prue.
Badge of honour.
Badge of honour, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, what about Diana
Gabaldon?
Yeah, because she's not someone, I mean, I know of her work, but I don't kind of read that genre. Yeah. So how was that for you, and what was she?
Okay, so Diana Gabaldon is a writer who I had absolutely devoured her books before I got to interview her for years. So she, for context for the listeners out there, she wrote the Outlander series that has become a television series and huge. I think it's on one of the, which I can't recall which platform it's on. But she came to New Zealand to talk about one of the books in that series. And, you know, given the opportunity to interview her, I was like, heck yes, you know, I'm a huge fan and have been for ages. In fact, her books were very kind of influential in my life in many practical ways. So in her books, the main characters are Claire Randall and Jamie Fraser. And Claire is like a modern day, when I say modern day, it's like post-World War II nurse who travels back in time to Scotland in the late 1700s. And so the stories actually, they're huge books, and they travel across generations.
They're world building.
Yeah, they are. They are. And, you know, currently moving into the family have shifted over to the United States. So with these books, it was, you know, I had this opportunity to talk with her. And she was incredible. Okay, so if those of you who know her books, her books, each one is a fairly hefty, large volume. So if you put them end on end, you've probably got about, I reckon,
A metre and a half of
books. And so, and the huge cast of characters and everything that she has in there across spans of time and everything like that. And one of the questions I asked her was, you know, how do you keep track of your characters? And she says, oh, I just remember them.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm like,
does she remember anything else?
Yeah. So I was like, I was flabbergasted. She said, no, she knew all the characters, who they were and everything. She's just got one of those brains that just organizes information
And holds it.
Yeah. You know, I have to look up my characters and remind myself what their mum's name is, you know, how old they are, that kind of thing. Yeah, she had a memory that retained all that. Just, again, a very, very clever woman and an incredible storyteller. And I think that's one of the things I've enjoyed about interviewing people who I sort of were feeling slightly intimidated about because they're international superstars and everything like that, was actually they're just ordinary people, were really generous with their time and the comments and stories that they tell on
and
radio.
Isn't it
really
that
kind.
They, yeah, that they are going, you know, that they can obviously be in the Times of London sort of thing. You know, so to actually consider doing our show as well speaks well both of the show and of you. Finally, let's end on just a slightly lighter note when things didn't quite go according to plan, particularly when you're talking with English crime writer RJ Ellery.
Yes. So again, RJ Ellery was a writer who was touring, and he did a talk at the Dunedin Public Libraries, and he's an English crime writer, and the book that he was, I think it was The Saints of New York, was the book that he was touring with at that time. So I'd been along and listened to his talk at the public library and then arranged to interview him. I wasn't able to do that in studio, and so in those situations the radio station has like portable recording equipment that you can take with you. So I had my backpack with my portable radio equipment and my microphones and the microphone stands, and we'd arranged to meet in the hotel he was staying at, in one of the
like the conference rooms or
something? Yeah, it was in one of those sort of spaces, and they'd set everything all up and we're all ready to go, and I go to sort of like hit record on the device and get it all going. And the recording player and it started sparking, blue electricity. And it was like, you can see the nice, you know, ozone sparky burning smell happening, and you could actually visibly see the electricity arcing. So, yeah, that interview didn't go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, so you had to cancel the whole thing.
I didn't have a smartphone or anything that, you know, back then that I could just like, oh, okay, let's just do an interview on that. No. And oddly enough, RJ didn't want to be electrocuted. And his publicist was quite firm that he did not want to be electrocuted.
Yeah, actually other things to do that day as well. Yeah, there was a bit of a health and safety.
Any
other things like that stick out? Any kind of other...
I think that's probably the major whoopsie I've had. The only other thing that I will laugh about is that my uncanny ability to stuff up doing the music. So when you're hosting a radio show, you're in charge of the whole station, basically, and you have this nice board in front of you with sliders and little volume controls. The one thing that I have never managed to get my handle around is the CD player. So yeah, I have not. There's not been often times where I had dead space where I've forgotten to turn on a microphone or anything like that. But I have messed up the songs on numerous occasions over the years.
Well, we're going to put you on the spot, Vanda.
We are going to.
Yeah, I asked you to bring in one of your favourite tracks just as a nice swan song for you. So let's see if we get the right track.
Yeah.
I know it's Golden Horse. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit why you like this particular track?
Yeah. Okay. Well, before I play this track, I just want to give a last little shout out and just sort of say thank you so much to Leslie and the team here at Otago Access Radio and the teams over the years that I've been doing this, because one of the lovely things about community radio is that everyone's just so supportive and they're getting people in broadcasting who are nervous and have no idea what they're doing, but it's a community and it really does feel at heart like a community station. So I sort of feel that I have received back more in abundance than what I have given through the opportunities that have come about by doing this show over these years. So, yeah, I feel immensely grateful to everyone here and very thankful that I was brave enough to put my hand up and just do it anyway. Feel the fear, do it.
Oh, well, I'm in that space right now, so I hope I can do half as well as you did, Vanda. So, right. Yeah.
So with the music, one of the things that, again, because, you know, the show is all about promoting and highlighting local authors, is that I've always just played New Zealand music on the show over the years. That was my thing. Because, again, if we don't play it, people don't get used to it. They don't hear it. They don't learn to embrace it. And one of the tracks that I'm going to play that I've played quite regularly is a Golden Horse track, and it's called Maybe Tomorrow. And I think one of the reasons I do like the song in particular is it's kind of upbeat and cheerful, which is a bit like me. I'm a very optimistic, upbeat, and a cheerful kind of a girl. So I thought it most appropriate, because I would have played this song, you know, probably 20 plus times over the years, but it just sings to me. So this is Golden Horses, Maybe Tomorrow, hopefully, if I push the right button and don't mess up the music.
And just before you do, in case we do run out of time, I just want to say thank you so much, and it's been great talking to you, Vander. I wish you all the best for the future. I know it'll be a busy one. And then to our listeners, talk to you next time, but meanwhile, keep reading and keep writing. Take it away, Vander.
Fingers crossed.
There's a story I know. We all leave and let go. There is nothing to hold us. In a moment of time, when the fruit becomes wine and the thought becomes the memory, all your sorrow, maybe tomorrow, will fade away in the air. Trying to please me, making it easy, it won't be there, it won't be there in your life, in your life. There's a story I know, we all leave and let go, there is nothing to hold.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalize your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.